teachers.
All right. So yeah, we've asked James and Francis just to start off the conversation with some initial preliminary remarks, and then we'll go ahead and move and open up the questions to the audience.
And all three of these papers have been extremely interesting. And so one of the things that I'd like to do is not so much to address each of them individually, as just to talk a little bit about the kinds of problems that I think we're all trying to think through as we think about the usefulness of digital instruments to us. One question that emerges with particular intensity is one about the relationship between what Franco Moretti repeatedly calls the digital production of knowledge and an individual's experiential understanding of a text. Moretti clearly wants to draw a bright line of division between the two, but it's not clear to me that the distinction is as easily drawn or as readily maintained as he suggests. To wit, he reports in Literary Lab Pamphlet Number 5, a declining presence for loud speaking verbs in 19th century novels, a finding that directly, if inadvertently, echoes Jacques Rancière's claim about the progressive movement from oratorical declamation to the quieter mode of text addressed to anyone. Digital humanities enable us to count things more rapidly than individuals can do. In that respect, it's a formalist enterprise in the way that many social scientific disciplines are. But it also replicates the kind of tensions that exist between quantitative sociology and symbolic sociology of the kind that someone like Irving Goffman practiced. One of the interesting features of quantitative work in the humanities is that it tends to move in the same ways as much minimally assisted work of the past. Vladimir Propp's Morphology of the Folk or Fairy Tale, or Claude Lévi-Strauss's Structural Study of Myth, with its call for more computer punch cards and faster computers, still looks surprisingly advanced. One area that seems to me particularly fruitful at the moment is what one might think of as a digital philology. Peter Davola of the University of Cambridge has in his very recent The Architecture of Concepts, which just came out in 2013, provided a very interesting example. Dictionaries are now able to grow to the size that makes publication in book form impracticable. Think here of the predicament of the Oxford English Dictionary, which now has so much material that it may have to move exclusively to digital publication. But intellectual historians require a more shaped account of the meaning of words, not just an iteration of various uses, but an account of the way in which those words functioned in debates. Davola thus recognizes the ways in which Raymond Williams, with his notion of key words, and Quentin Skinner, have sought to understand the historical specificity of words. And Davola has recourse to large databases, such as that of 18th century collections online, to come up with a sample that will approximate collective langue rather than individual parole. Rights is a key term for Davola, but identifying the importance of the word sets problems rather than resolving them. Rights, in the first place, is used by both sides in a fractious debate in the 18th century. And in the second, Davola also sees the need to ask if what some 18th century commentators meant by rights is what 20th and 21st century commentators mean by rights. He gets at the project of disambiguating a natural rights account from a politically progressive one, largely by looking at clusters of words, the words that regularly appear within 25 or 50 words of the word rights. And he ends up being able to make some important claims about when people are and aren't participating in the same part of the langue as one another. Essentially, it seems to me, he's making an implicit argument that the structure of language use reveals the importance of specific statements of position even more clearly than the direct statements of position themselves. And in one of the things that I think is particularly interesting in our discussion, he's great at slicing his sets of data, though he does it by decade rather than by individual year, and manages to come up with very interesting possibilities about how you can document the importance of things like the Pittite governmental reign of terror against its own citizenry in the 1790s just by looking at the relative frequency of some of his key works.
Okay. Thanks. Hi. So I'm going to, I suppose in contrast, just speak in very detailed ways about a few things that I found. I think these presentations were all, you know, very interesting, and I just, you know, had tons of questions and a few potential suggestions. I think the first one was, in all this kind of, in these contingency tables, for example, that Andrew was presenting, you know, so the kind of true, false, positives and all their various functions. I'm guessing that the ground truth, or I should say maybe the gold standard, was you. Was it you? I mean, so all this is contingent on you and somebody. I'm guessing it's not the author, because, you know, these are deceased authors.
Yeah, it's a recursive, it's a problem of recursivity. Like, we have the computer derive something, we have people derive something, which then we measure if those derivations are accurate or not.
Based on your assessment.
Well,
so you
using
look at
people
them
and then me assessing those people. And so we could check the validity of the assessors and the validity of the assessors' validity and so
right.
forth.
But the truth table is, the accuracy, all these things require, some numbers are in there. And
It's me reviewing students, reviewing Amazon Turk people.
Okay.
And I didn't know how to stop that problem.
Okay. Well, I would say, you know, so in some crowdsourcing experiments of my own, one thing first that, you know, creating a two-layer problem is often very useful. So having people kind of generate these, you know, data basically, and then have other people evaluate these data. And typically, we found in a variety of experiments that people are much better at saying that something is false than that saying something is true. So, for example, we had a generator experiment where people were generating synonyms and reviewers. So second-level reviewers were much more accurate at saying that something wasn't true than that something was true. And it turns out there's some statistical. It's harder to make an assessment of a point value than it is when something's completely different. So you can work those into a multi-stage crowdsourcing experiment that's useful. I would say a second thing is, in assessing these, you know, specificity and recall, that the way in which, well, it's good when there's two, but it's problematic when there's more. Obviously the problem with that is that it's fragile when it's just two, because you don't know what those two people are agreeing on, versus when you have many more people, okay, there's fewer things they agree on, but it's robust what it is they do agree on. So one way to incorporate that is in a series of annotator models, where you're actually predicting the accuracy you're co-predicting the accuracy of the annotator and the annotation at the same time. So presumably, for example, you can imagine you have trolls in your crowdsourcing experiment who just constantly rate things the same way. So, you know, there was an annotator in our own department's prelim, for example, last year, who annotated all the tests with the same score. You know, so no variance, bad annotator. If it just so happens that there's low variance on a particular item, it could be that annotator just, you know, randomly has that assignment on that thing. Now, so if you have the very slight assumption that people are, on average, more likely to be accurate than less accurate, then there are a whole family of kind of fixed and random effects models where you can kind of co-estimate the accuracy of the person and the accuracy of the item. And it turns out that does a lot better than if you just use some voter model where, you know, on average, these people are correct. And you can apply those models also to this second layer censoring algorithm, where people are assessing the accuracy of other people's initial assessments. So I think that's, you know, really modeling the accuracy ends up being valuable, not just in assessing the numbers, but then you can fold those back into predictions about what the actual or what better assessments are. So a second question I had was, you talked about, you know, how detective fiction ends up, you know, valorizing or demonstrating social openness and complexity. And I guess I'm thinking of a kind of very local pragmatics, you know, that not that it doesn't do those things, but, you know, what is it that, you know, the form is, or the author is kind of doing? What are they trying to accomplish? And perhaps one of the things is surprise, you know, maximizing surprise, preserving, pushing surprise to the end. In that case, it seems like a number of these different pieces of the analysis can kind of be drawn together and some other metrics kind of pop out. So for example, you'd expect, you know, that information theoretically that you'd have more entropy over the ties, you know, that you'd be less certain about, you know, where it is that the detective is going to go in any one moment. And you'd also expect that the ties as they're revealed, even though more of them are revealed later, and probably in bursts later as you have kind of false leads and then eventually the final resolution, that the ones that are revealed later are also the ones that are the most informative, which is to say that they restructure the path structure of the network later. So I think thinking through, you know, the logic of the storyline and how it might map onto to these networks in tighter ways. And I think, like, for example, when you talk about if the detective is removed, then they may be less consequential than a central character in other short fiction, well, it's also likely that there may be more hidden edges from more parts of the story, and then, you know, so this then links to this idea that it takes longer to reveal the edges in general, and then poses the question of, are the edges that in fact get revealed later in the story more informative of the whole structure of the network, or change the path structure through the network? So I thought it was a fascinating investigation. I think there's probably ways to tie, and I thought the idea of random models was interesting, random models of the structure of the network as you were describing, but you could also then produce models and random models of the process by which the story evolves from one place to another. And that, I think, becomes very interesting, not just in the context of the network structure of characters, but also the network structure of claims, right, or hypotheses about, you know, the relationship between an act and a person, you know, which is invariably the you know, primary trope or claim of one of these detective novels. To Tom's interesting work on Sur in Argentina, I thought the network diagrams were beautiful and interesting. They were complex at the same time, you know, because you, like, it was all in there, you know. The poets were in there, and the journals were in there, and why not just throw the text in there too, you know? You know, and there, all the links are preserved, and I think, you know, at one level, it might be useful to kind of have layers of complexity, you know. So, okay, so how would we think? I mean, you're imputing a set of binaries about, you know, characterizations of one field of journals over another field, and you know, you were kind of also talking about, you know, the meaningfulness of region. Those things weren't visible in the same graph, and so there might be ways to kind of cut through this. So, for example, if you do some community detection to kind of have that layered onto this, and remove some of the complexity as you add these other kinds of simplifying or dimension reducing layers. A second question is, you set up the problematic from the perspective of the particular ties that we were looking at, which were the journals connected by authors, and it wasn't obvious to me that that this would have been the primary tie through which one might have thought about communicativity. And so you certainly talk about later, you know, oh, hey, if you bring in the translation network, then it's different. And maybe if you bring in the stylistic network, then it's different. Certainly, you know, co-references, phrases, topics or subjects, actual proper subjects like named entities which are recognized or kind of co-referenced or normalized nouns, all these things would give a rich sense of the kinds of things, the layers of things that could be kind of transmuted through these networks, right? So obviously there are people who are reading these things who aren't themselves the people who are publishing both places. And so going through the layers of influence end up, you know, might end up kind of characterizing, okay, well, you know, which types of influence propose a maximally different set of paths of influence than others. You know, you can kind of cluster them based on their topology. And I would say a final thing, throughout the talk, there was this interest in, well, how does this relate to, you know, the canonized standard view? And, you know, so we have this very, well, reasonably precise view of now, you know, the history of production, but we don't have a comparable, topology of the standard view, the canonical view. Like, who said, who made that view? You know, how strong was that made? And what's the distribution of, at some level, that comparison itself is the thing that begs a formalization so that you can talk about, well, you know, rather than just, you know, how do different types of influence cluster against one another, which types of influence are the ones that map onto the standard view? You suggest this at the end when you talk about the way in which, you know, these female poets end up integrating the network relative to the standard view. But if you were able to do that in a more intensively sampled way, then it kind of, it suggests an origin story of where the standard view came from, which then itself becomes interesting. And then finally, just briefly, Dennis's analysis, it seemed to me, you're right, I mean, networks are, you know, I mean, you know, there's a mess there. And yet at the same time, it seemed to me, you know, here that I was just wondering, you know, are there scaling phenomena? Are there, you know, what are the kinds of dynamics that are taking place? And it wasn't obviously visible even when you just kind of cut out things, because really, as the system grows, is everything growing proportionally in that system? It seems not. It seems that there are, you know, major hubs that have the same relative weight and importance early and late. And if that's true, if they're basically seeders, as you call them, are the ones who are producing essentially almost all of the content, you know, aside from maybe the authors that are you know, putting their own work out there. I mean, effectively, that's what happened. There's a few people, you know, seven people that are pushing all the content. Then it doesn't, I certainly don't see any evidence of them trying to keep other people out, right? So it may be just that the relative value of just getting, you know, of just leeching, as you say, in the system is so great that there's no need. In fact, there's no need probably even to present your own books there, you know, because one of these seven other producers is likely gonna do it for you. So it's not, it seems to me, I mean, maybe you have other reasons to believe this, but it seems that it may become like a general resource. And that general resource means that really there's no additional benefit to my own production of or placing books in that system. Anyway, so those are very individual thoughts.
Keep the mic, yeah, okay. So I think, you know, given we have about 10, 15 minutes till the break, I think we'd like to sort of, panelists can respond, but we'd also like to hear from the audience if there are specific questions. Are there questions? Yeah.
For Andrew and for Dennis, it occurs to me that there could possibly be some algorithmic overlap between your projects and, say, the project of the National Security Agency in terms of mapping networks. I'm wondering if, for example, the like institutional review board might be indifferent to the networking of fictional characters in detective novels, but is there a similar indifference when you're form scraping, Dennis, in with non-fictional characters?
Wait, can you repeat that last part? The difference between...
When you scrape forms, you're dealing with non-fictional characters.
Yes, real people.
And I understand that future review boards have something to say about that when that kind of research is being done in an academic setting.
Yeah, so it's an interesting...
It's strange that some of this research on networking could very likely have some interesting parallels with the intelligence gathering on real-world networks being conducted. Perhaps with similar algorithms?
So, interesting story. So, I think it was a surprise to me that there is a continuum between open access and surveillance. If you think about, they're kind of the same thing. So another one of my projects where we have collected an archive of over 1 million syllabi. Turns out that the people who are really interested in collecting and analyzing syllabi is the school board of Texas to make sure that evolution is being taught properly and there's not kind of too much marks in whatever. So that anytime you collect data, there is you're immediately in this kind of you're enmeshed in surveillance slash access praxis. I don't know what to call it. Early on, I was very keen to make sure that I don't get in trouble, to make sure that my students don't get in trouble. We posted all of our lab notebooks like this, and really all of our data online right away, just for everybody to see. And quickly, we had people from the community that we're studying, kind of come and flame and deface our materials a little bit, and there was pushback. Others in the community that we made contact with were kind of glad and saw our efforts as being a kind of a near side, as promoting global access and kind of trying to fix inequality of access globally. So yes, it's a huge problem. For me, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Just talking about it openly, this is something that I do when I do a talk just on piracy. That's something that I bring up, and it's something that I talk about with my students and the people who I study as well. But great question.
I found that the presentation, the sort of visual geography of Latin American journals, fascinating. And I'd like to go into Sue a little further, and you mentioned translation, that there's largely close coterie or hermetic group that was involved in Sewell, but it was opened by the larger percentage of translation. And if you go down in the reeds amongst the translators, I think you might find a lot of those are Argentine, right?
That a lot of the translators are Argentine?
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
But that's kind of part of the argument, right? Is that they're provincial within the relationship to the rest of the network.
Right.
But they're cosmopolitan in terms of their translation. They're very interested in bringing in outside influences, but not outside influences from Chile right next door, or Uruguay, right, with Juana de America. She lives in Montevideo, she's just across the river, and yet never appears, never is published in Sur or in any of the other Argentine journals.
So one explanation might be sort of national character explanation. I'm popular joke that whenever there's lightning, Argentines think that God is taking a photograph.
Well, this is the cliche, right? So this is the cliche that we begin with, and a kind of snobismo of the Argentinians, right? And so now are we proving, you know, providing data so that everyone can make those jokes, but say it's really true, actually. I don't think that's the. I hope that's not where the data and the project is going. But it is an attempt to think about, you know, not just Argentina or Sur's distance in terms of questions of influence and production, but also how this regional network, how this group that was defined and continues to, a number of people continue to insist on the definition of an Our America, right? How that would be distributed in ways that are surprising to us, and in fact, how the Argentinian poets might actually connect with groups that are far from them geographically and sometimes temporally through some of the interest in translation, which I don't think is exactly cosmopolitanism. I don't think it's exactly that same type of model. I think there's something else going on there with that third term. But also, you know, all of the questions that you bring up in terms of influence and how tracking influence and readership. I mean, one of the things that literary scholars who work on this period invest a lot in is, you know, how do you deal with that issue of influence? We don't have huge subscription lists. We don't. So one of my intuition is that some type of machine learning here in a style version of machine learning style, would look across the corpora, not just to look at poets as producers of poetry, but also as readers of poetry. And that might be one other way to think about connections across the network. I don't know if that is a potentially rich model to think about readership influence, but it's a problem within literary history to make these claims that there is an influence traveling, but to not really have the data to help at least point to a richer version of that history.
Right, and so in this case, I mean, it seems like you'd want a model of actual inheritance by which you can essentially identify weak signals of horizontal transmission, mm-hmm. which is effectively through readership over
right.
time, right? And so that, I think that's part of the challenge is like building essentially a model that's conditioned on actually what is the heritability of style, you know, so that you can identify transmission when it occurs, right, and where it occurs through particular people, for example.
Right. Well, so. It'll give you. I mean, you've already got a really nice idea. Like you've got a really complicated concept of provincial that you've got two different models for. If it's things circulating through a region versus things being imported lexically. And you can imagine once you begin to get some of the more lexical analysis, you're going to find out, does that still hold? Are there similarities between the Argentine poems and the other regional poems at the level of language, or the Argentinian poems referencing? Is there sort of linguistic imaginary also, not provincial, but more global?
Right.
And that those two data points, I think, would give you a really nice story of models of provincialism. It's really neat.
Right.
This was probably one of the most interestingly disorienting panels I've ever listened to. It was also the most heteroglossic in the Bakhtinian sense. Some of the voices I've heard, I feel like, represent the current positions available to humanists and visual humanities. So, Dennis, you're sort of invested in kind of new media studies critique, like critiquing the nature of data. Like, what is, you have these networks up, what do they mean? They're actually this, it's all chaotic. Tom was probably the most invested in traditional literary historicism, narratives of literary evolution, writers, journals, their relationship. And then Andrew, probably the closest to a kind of social scientific methodology, looking at causality, formalization, concepts. And then this was actually replicated in the responses, which are really great, but incredibly different. I mean, I think the essential epistemologies underlying your comments, which is really fundamentally different. Francis, you're really interested in De Bola's work, which is thinking like a really interesting question of how computational methods can help us understand how rights might have meant something, not just syntactically, but conceptually in different periods. To you, that seems a payoff of digital humanities. James, you're more interested in questions of structure, explanation, causality, formalization, really great suggestions and comments. I need some of this to come together, though. methodologically, some of these, you know, different just ways of thinking about culture, literature, text, the unspoken, deep methodological divisions that exist between the social sciences and the humanities. Panelists can kind of speak to each other more, the different kind of voices, how they can come together. It's very disoriented in a very interesting way, and they do represent the confusion of the humanities right now, but I hope that there can be some convergence. Yeah.
One of the things that seems to me particularly interesting about what De Bola is doing
uh-huh.
is that because he's looking at words,
right.
he doesn't have to worry about whether or not people agree on what those words are.
Mm-hmm.
He just does search.
Right.
And so there's no question of whether or not various different observers are going to code those words differently.
Right, right.
And it's only when he starts looking at the clustering
right.
that he's able to talk about some kind of significant de-synonymization. But one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about the sort of thing that Dennis is doing here is that it seems to me that he's trying to talk about what it's like to come up with a hierarchy of participants that absolutely mirrors the kinds of discussions that people have about things like the rise of professionalism. You know, even though you're talking about piracy rather than legitimate professional production. The kind of thing that someone like Perry Miller wants to say about what happens with the professions of law and medicine and theology in the 19th century looks incredibly the kind of thing that you're doing. And it's a way of talking about how people start imagining that there is some kind of agreement about what counts as real knowledge in a particular area and an appropriate way of behaving. So I thought that that was a particularly interesting thing, that you were trying to get at a very small number of participants in a way that reflected a kind of agreement.
I was just going to throw on because they seem, I actually found things much more homogenous than I would have expected in advance. In the sense that everybody was basically looking for communities and was very agnostic towards language use, actually. Like, none of us was doing any text mining on our text. And in fact, we were coming up with these sort of proxies for a thing called a community. And you know, we learned that piracy, for all of its decentralized rhetoric, looks incredibly centralized from the point of view that you gave it to us. And this, you know, the same idea was, Tom, you were sort of pulling out the kind of spaces and whether they constitute communities. Does co-publication equal a community or not? Like, that sort of a really interesting question. And what is for my question is, what is an interaction? Does that count? What does that count for? And if you have enough of them, does that count as a social? Is that a proxy for sociability or sociality or a social anything? And I think behind each of those is still like really open questions as whether our proxies count for what we're saying they count for. But we've created these mediators that are semantically neutral, which is sort of the fun part, I think, of it as a literary person to back up from language. But that's still asking whether they're socially referential. I don't know, that to me was like the kind of theoretical question that was hanging in the balance for me of each, in my own preparing and thinking about each presentation.
I think to respond to these comments, I think there is I do think that, and to respond to your original comment, is that I do have more granular data that shows centralization, that there is kind of people contribute at some point. There is people contribute a lot, and there are maybe, instead of seven core people, there are maybe 100, and then it gets pared down. And there's a very good reason for it. Once you start dipping into the actual history, when you do some of the field work, so I have the logs of the forum. I can actually go back to 2004 and see what they decided to do to actually constrain access. And I find that, so the empirical insight is supported by some just qualitative history making. And I think all of these talks, we are using the same methodology, all of these research projects. But I think the most difficult thing is going from these beautiful pictures and going from these clusters and kind of the metrics of the network to some real world phenomenon, right? What does the cluster represent? And that's a very difficult to connect the quantitative, to connect, and also to connect the often the arbitrary side effects of a network to a real world event. That takes a lot of work. And that's why I try to just say, at this point, exploratory, right? Confirmation maybe comes later. At this point, I'm very okay to produce, I feel okay about producing kind of just beautiful pictures that are evocative and that confirm or challenge some of the intuitions that we have from kind of the homeland of our field. Does that make sense?
So I would just throw out one thing that I think, I mean, it seemed to me that I think the challenge, I mean, these are, these networks are, I mean, in your case, how many nodes are the network?
Half a million.
Okay, so 500,000 minus one dimensional networks, or that could be that. I mean, it's certainly, not necessarily going to be that long, but so extremely high dimensional networks. And so one thing we can do is cut them into communities, but it seems like the stories that we're telling are different from just the existence of communities. They're about emergence and like linkage, and so it seems to me that I'd be excited to see you know, like a richer vocabulary of, you know, simplexes that were like cutting through these networks, you know, than just, you know, big clumps, because the stories that you're telling and that you're interested in telling are so much richer, that, you know, in some sense, you know, I'd love to see some of that richness reflected in the thing that, you know, we use to cut through these stories. And then, you know, I mean, there's, I think those would both be discovery tools, but then also potential confirmatory things that.